Okay, so today we're gonna hop down the rabbit hole.
Oh, I like that.
Right, we're talking Peter Rabbit,
Yeah.
but not the cute bedtime story version.
Yeah.
This time Peter's in like a legal battle that's way more tangled than Mr. McGregor's garden.
Yeah, it really is. In this case, Frederick Warren & Co. v. Booksales, Inc. It's fascinating because it throws us right into this intersection of copyright and trademark law.
Yeah, it's a real head scratcher, and we're talking like a 1979 case where some of Beatrix Potter's like original Peter Rabbit stories had entered the public domain. So at this point, anyone could just reprint them.
Exactly.
Really.
But Warren, the original publisher, they claimed they still had trademark rights over certain illustrations, and they were saying that these images were so connected to their brand that people didn't just see a rabbit, they saw Warren's Peter Rabbit.
So hold on, even though the stories themselves were free to use, Warren is saying you couldn't just use any picture of Peter Rabbit, you had to use their specific picture.
That's exactly it.
Wow.
Warren argued that those illustrations had acquired what's called secondary meaning.
Okay.
It means they went beyond just being pictures and actually represented Warren's brand in the public's mind. Think of it this way. You know, when you need a tissue, do you ask for a facial tissue or a Kleenex?
Okay, yeah, I see what you mean. People do that all the time.
Right.
They use the brand name to refer to the whole product in general. So Warren was basically saying that those Peter Rabbit illustrations were like their version of Kleenex.
Precisely. And this is where it gets legally interesting.
Okay.
To prove secondary, meaning Warren would need evidence like consumer surveys showing people specifically linked those illustrations to Warren's strong sales figures for their Peter Rabbit books and a history of like licensing those images for merchandise.
So if they could show that they'd been putting those exact illustrations on Peter Rabbit toys, lunchboxes, all that stuff for years, that would help their case.
Exactly. It would help demonstrate that those images weren't just generic rabbit pictures. They were like a distinctive part of Warren's brand identity.
Okay, so help me out here with this whole like copyright versus trademark thing. They both deal with intellectual property, but how are they different?
Think of it this way. Copyright protects the specific expression of an idea, like the text of a book or the lines of an illustration. It's time limited, and once it expires, that work enters the public domain.
Right.
Trademark, on the other hand, protects symbols or designs that identify and distinguish goods or services in the marketplace.
Oh.
And a trademark can theoretically last forever as long as it's being actively used and renewed.
So Warren was basically saying that even though the copyright on the Peter Rabbit stories might have expired, their trademark on those particular illustrations was still valid because they had become synonymous with their brand.
You got it.
Okay.
But here's the twist. The case never actually went to trial.
Oh, wow.
So we don't know for sure if Warren had all the evidence they needed to prove secondary meaning.
That's a huge cliffhanger.
It is.
But it raises a big question, doesn't it? Can you actually trademark parts of something that's already in the public domain?
That is like the million-dollar question.
Yeah.
And it's one that courts are still grappling with today.
I bet, because it seems like there's this real tension there. On the one hand, you want to protect creators and companies that have invested in building a brand. But on the other hand, you don't want to lock up these cultural icons forever and prevent others from reimagining them or doing something new with them.
Absolutely. And that's why the Warren case is so important. It really highlights the complexities of balancing those competing interests.
So let's unpack this a bit further. What are some of the key takeaways from the Warren case, especially for creators and businesses trying to protect their work even after copyright might expire?
Well, the case certainly emphasizes the importance of building a strong brand identity and being consistent in how you present your work to the world. You know, it's not just about creating something great, it's about making sure people associate specific elements with your brand.
So you're saying if Warren had been really diligent about putting those specific Peter Rabbit illustrations on everything from books to merchandise, their case for trademark protection would have been stronger.
You're getting it. Okay. It's all about creating that undeniable connection in the consumer's mind. Those illustrations need to scream Warren's Peter Rabbit, not just any generic bunny.
But wait, didn't the court in Warren also look at how similar the other company's illustrations were? So even if Warren had built a strong brand, they'd still have a problem if someone was basically copying their images, right?
You're absolutely right. The court also considered what's called likelihood of confusion.
Okay.
Would the average person looking at the other company's Peter Rabbit books think they were buying a book from Warren? How similar were the illustrations? Were they used in the same way? It's not just about line for line copying, it's about the overall impression created.
Though it's not enough to just have a strong brand. You also need to be unique and make sure no one else is creating something that could be easily confused with your work.
Exactly. It's like a two-pronged approach. Build a strong brand identity and protect that identity from potential infringers.
This is making my head spin a little, but before we get too lost in legal weeds, can we talk about some real-world examples beyond Peter Rabbit? Are there other cases that illustrate these concepts of secondary meaning and likelihood of confusion?
Oh, absolutely. Think about Sherlock Holmes. The early stories are in the public domain, meaning anyone can use them.
Right.
But later stories are still under copyright.
Oh, wow.
So you have this fascinating situation where certain elements of the character are free for all while others are still protected.
Wow, that sounds like a recipe for legal headaches.
It's been tricky for sure. Courts have had to decide how much of the character is fair game for others to use without infringing on those copyrighted elements. Like, can you show Sherlock using cocaine, even though that detail wasn't in the public domain stories? It gets very nuanced.
Yeah, that's a great example. It really highlights the challenges of navigating copyright and trademark law when dealing with like iconic characters.
Yeah.
What about other examples? I'm thinking Disney must have some interesting cases given how fiercely they protect their intellectual property.
Oh, you bet. A classic example is Steamboat Willie, the early Mickey Mouse cartoon. The original copyright was about to expire.
Right.
But Disney successfully lobbied for extensions, keeping Mickey under their control for much longer. And they've been very strategic about using trademark law to maintain control, even as copyrights expire.
It's like they built a whole empire on the back of one mouse.
Right.
But this brings up another question. If companies are using trademark law to essentially get, like, evergreen copyright protection, isn't that a bit of a problem? I mean, isn't the whole point of copyright that it eventually expires so that works can enter the public domain and inspire new creativity?
You've hit on a key policy dilemma.
Yeah.
There's this constant push and pull between rewarding creators for their work and ensuring that cultural works eventually become part of our shared heritage.
Right. It's like trying to balance the interest of companies and creators with the public's right to access and build upon existing creative works.
Exactly. And this is where the Warren case, even though it didn't have a clear-cut resolution, really gets us thinking. It forces us to ask, where do we draw the line between protecting intellectual property and ensuring that cultural works become part of our shared heritage?
Definitely a lot to ponder. So for all the creators and businesses out there, what's the big takeaway from all of this? How can they build that kind of brand recognition where their work is instantly recognizable, like Warren was trying to do with those Peter Rabbit illustrations?
The Warren case offers a valuable lesson in strategic brand building. One key takeaway is to register your most distinctive designs as trademarks early on. Think about your book cover's logos. Unique character designs. Don't wait until someone tries to use something similar and then scramble to claim ownership.
So be proactive about protecting those elements that make your work stand out.
Precisely, and the second key is consistency. Use those trademarked elements across all your products, marketing materials, everything. The more consistent you are, the stronger the association between those elements, and your brand will become in the public's mind.
So it's not just about creating something cool. It's about having a long-term strategy to build that brand recognition.
Absolutely. And don't underestimate the power of licensing. Your work for merchandise and adaptations can really help solidify that link between your brand and those key visual elements.
So if Warren had been licensing those Peter Rabbit illustrations for toys and clothing all along, it would bolster their trademark argument.
Definitely. It all goes back to creating that consistent and widespread presence in the marketplace, which can be crucial in establishing that secondary meaning.
Okay, that's incredibly helpful. And a final thought for our listeners before we move on.
The Warren case really underscores the need to think about intellectual property strategically from the very beginning. Don't just focus on copyright. Think about the long game and how trademark law can help you protect your most valuable assets in the long run.
Sounds like smart advice for anyone in the creative world. Thanks for breaking all of that down for us.
My pleasure. It's always a good time to dive into the fascinating world of trademarks and copyrights.
Yeah, absolutely. And for our listeners, we'll be back soon with part two of our deep dive into this fascinating case.
Looking forward to it. And remember, the court in Warren, they didn't like completely shut the door on trademarking public domain elements.
Okay.
They said it was a high bar to clear but possible if you could prove that secondary meaning.
Okay, so let's say I'm an artist or a publisher who wants to protect my work even after copyright expires.
Mm-hmm.
What are some practical tips based on this case?
Well, documentation is key.
Okay.
Keep meticulous records of how you're using those images or characters, marketing materials, licensing agreements, anything that shows consistent use over time. You know, it's like building a case file from day one.
So it's about being strategic about how you present it to the world and how you protect what makes it unique.
Exactly. And this is where the Warn case gets really interesting.
Okay.
It also delves into this idea of likelihood of confusion. The court had to consider how similar Book Sales Inc.'s illustrations were to Warn's, how they were used, and if the average person would be confused into thinking they were buying a Warn book.
So even if someone didn't copy an illustration exactly, it could still be a problem if the overall impression was too similar, like if they changed Peter's coat from blue to red, but everything else was the same.
That's a great question, and that's where the nuances come in.
Yeah.
The court in Warn really emphasized context. You know, book covers versus interior art, for example, might have different implications.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to consider how the illustrations are used in marketing and merchandise. It's like piecing together a puzzle to get a clear picture of potential confusion.
So as a creator, I need to be thinking about how to build a strong brand identity that's clearly associated with my work and not just generic elements anyone could use.
You nailed it. It's about creating something distinctive and then using it consistently. So consumers come to associate those elements with you and only you. And it's not just about legal protection, it's smart business.
This case is from 1979, though. How relevant is it in the digital age where images and characters are constantly being shared and remixed online?
That's a question that keeps IP lawyers up at night.
I bet.
The principles from Warn are still very much relevant. You know, secondary likelihood of confusion, those are still core to trademark law.
Right.
But the digital landscape adds a whole new layer of complexity.
I can imagine with things like memes and fan art.
Yeah.
Where is the line between fair use and infringement?
It's a blurry line for sure, but the Warn case gives us some guidance.
Okay.
If you're using elements of a copyrighted or trademarked work in a way that's transformative, you know, adding new meaning or commentary, you might have a stronger fair use argument.
So if I made a meme of Peter Rabbit wearing a Supreme hoodie commenting on consumerism, that might be okay.
It could be, but it's not a guaranteed win. You know, courts would also look at things like if you're making money from it and whether your use might harm the market for the original work.
So proceed with caution in the memosphere. But this raises another point. The Warren case suggests companies can maintain some control over creations even after copyright expires. Doesn't that clash with the whole idea of the public domain?
You've hit on a major policy dilemma.
Yeah.
There's this constant tension between protecting creators' rights and ensuring that creative works eventually become part of our shared cultural heritage.
You want to reward creators and incentivize them to make awesome stuff,
yeah.
But you also don't want to lock up ideas and characters forever.
Precisely, cases like Warn force us to grapple with these questions and find a balance. And in today's world where digital tech makes copying and remixing easier than ever, these questions are more pressing than ever.
So connecting this to the bigger picture, what does Warn tell us about the future of intellectual property law?
I think it highlights a few key trends. First, the boundaries between copyright and trademark are becoming increasingly blurred, especially in the digital realm. Secondary meaning is becoming even more crucial for trademark rights. And third, courts will have to apply old legal principles to new technologies and forms of creative expression.
Sounds like IP law is going to be a wild ride in the years to come.
Oh, absolutely. Buckle up.
Okay.
But here's another interesting point. The Warren case also highlights the limitations of trademark law.
Like,
even if you can prove secondary meaning and likelihood of confusion, there are still limits to what you can control.
What do you mean?
Well, the court acknowledged that you can't trademark elements that are essential to the public domain work itself.
Okay.
So you couldn't trademark the name Peter Rabbit or the basic concept of a mischievous bunny. Those are free for anyone to use.
So you can't trademark the generic idea of a superhero, but you could trademark specific elements of your own unique hero, like their costume or powers.
Exactly. That's why it's so important to think about what makes your work truly distinctive and how you can build a brand around those unique elements.
Yes.
You know, it's about creating something that stands out in the marketplace.
Makes sense. So for budding creators out there, what's the key takeaway from Warn?
Don't just focus on protecting your work from being copied. Think about how to create a brand identity so strong and recognizable that it becomes synonymous with your work in the public's mind.
That's great advice. Speaking of strong brand identity, are there other real-world cases that illustrate this concept of secondary meaning? Talked about Sherlock Holmes and Mickey Mouse, but I'm curious about other examples.
Oh, tons. Think about the color Tiffany blue, that instantly recognizable shade of Robin's egg blue.
Oh, yeah.
Tiffany & Co. They don't own the color itself, but they've built such a strong association with it through their branding and marketing that it's become a trademark in its own right.
Wow, that's amazing. They took something in public domain, a color, and made it their own through sheer brand power.
Exactly. That's the power of trademark law. It allows you to protect those intangible elements that make your brand unique, even if they're not tied to a specific product.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. So it's not just about logos and slogans. It's about building a whole sensory experience around your brand that consumers instantly recognize.
You got it. And that's what companies like Tiffany & Co., Apple, Coca-Cola, they've done so brilliantly.
Right.
They've created a holistic brand identity that goes beyond their products. You know, it's about a feeling and aesthetic, a whole set of values that consumers associate with their brand.
It's like you don't just buy a Tiffany necklace, you buy into the whole Tiffany experience.
Exactly. That's what makes a brand truly powerful.
Okay, so we've covered the legal side, but what about practical implications for creators? How can they build that kind of brand recognition?
Well, it starts with creating high-quality work that people love.
Right.
But it's also about being strategic in how you present yourself.
Like having a consistent visual style across your website, social media, and marketing materials.
Exactly. And don't underestimate the power of storytelling. It's people connect with brands that have a compelling story. What are your values? What's your mission? Why should people care about what you do?
So it's not just what you create, but why you create it.
Absolutely. And that's something that can't be easily copied. It's what makes your brand truly unique.
This is all great advice. Any other tips for our listeners?
Be patient. Building a strong brand takes time and effort. Don't expect overnight success. Just keep creating great work. Be consistent with your branding and tell your story authentically.
Great words of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
So what does the future hold for trademark law, especially as technology keeps evolving at such a rapid pace?
Well, that's the million-dollar question.
Yeah.
But I think we'll see some interesting developments in the coming years. For one thing, the metaverse is going to create a whole new set of challenges and opportunities for trademark law.
How so?
Well, in the metaverse, brands will have to find new ways to assert their presence and protect their intellectual property in a virtual environment. You know, virtual goods, avatars, even virtual real estate. All of that will be subject to trademark disputes.
Wow, that's mind-blowing. So law is going to have to adapt to a whole new dimension of reality.
Exactly, and that's going to be a fascinating process to watch.
I can't wait to see what happens. But in the meantime, what's the key takeaway from the Warn case for creators and businesses navigating the ever-evolving world of intellectual property?
I think it's this: be proactive, be strategic, and be bold. Don't be afraid to assert your rights and protect your intellectual property, but also be open to new possibilities and don't let the fear of infringement stifle your creativity. The world needs your ideas.
That's a great message to end on. Thanks for taking us on this deep dive into the Warren case. It's been enlightening.
My pleasure. Always happy to geek out about IP law.
And for our listeners, we'll be back soon with another deep dive into the fascinating world of trademarks and copyrights. Until then, stay curious.
You know, it's amazing to think like how much the world has changed since 1979 when the Warren case was decided. I mean, the internet was barely a thing back then.
I know, right?
It makes you wonder how trademark law is going to like keep up with all the technological advances we're seeing today. It's definitely a challenge for the legal system to adapt at the pace of technology, but it's also an incredible opportunity to rethink some of our assumptions about intellectual property.
Can you give us some like specific examples? What are some of the emerging technologies that are really like pushing the boundaries of trademark law?
Well, we've already touched on the metaverse.
Right.
But let's dive a little deeper. Think about it. In the metaverse, you can create and sell virtual goods, clothing for avatars, even virtual real estate.
It's like a whole new economy is springing up in the digital world.
Exactly. And all of those virtual creations could potentially be trademarked, but it raises all sorts of interesting questions. For example, if you create a virtual handbag that looks just like a famous designer bag, is that trademark infringement or is it just a digital homage?
That's a tough one. I can see how lines would get blurred in the metaverse. Are there any other technologies that are having a major impact on trademark law?
Absolutely. Artificial intelligence is another game changer. AI-powered tools can now generate logos, brand names, even entire marketing campaigns in a matter of seconds.
Wow. So does that mean AI is going to replace human creativity?
Not necessarily, but it does raise questions about authorship and ownership. If an AI creates a logo, who owns the trademark rights? The programmer who created the AI? The user who inputted the prompts? Or could the AI itself be considered the owner? These are uncharted waters.
That's mind-blowing. It seems like we're on the verge of a whole new era of intellectual property law. Any advice for creators and businesses trying to stay ahead of the curve?
I think the key is to embrace innovation, but also be mindful of the legal implications. You know, experiment with new technologies like AI and the metaverse, but don't assume that because something is new, it's automatically outside the reach of trademark law. Do your research, consult with legal experts, and make sure you're protecting your intellectual property in this rapidly changing world.
Sounds like good advice.
Yeah.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into the Warn case and the future of trademark law, what are the key takeaways for our listeners?
I think the biggest takeaway is that trademark law is dynamic and constantly evolving. You know, we've seen how a case from 1979 involving a children's book character can still be relevant today. But we also have to recognize that new technologies are pushing us into uncharted territory.
Yeah, you're right. It's both fascinating and a little daunting to think about all the changes happening in the world of intellectual property. But I think you've given our listeners a lot to think about. Thanks for sharing your insights with us today.
My pleasure. It's been a great discussion.
And to our listeners, thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the Frederick Warren & Co. Book Sales, Inc. I guess we'll be back soon with another exploration of the ever-evolving world of trademarks and copyrights. Until then, stay curious.